Well, good day and welcome back to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and I'm excited to be back here. We had Sam and the gang carry the load themselves a little bit a few weeks ago and recorded an episode, she, Joe, and Jim together from the guys over at Paragon Medical Education Group and gave me a little bit of a break, but I'm back here and I'm excited to get on with the rest of the show. And Sam, you're out there as well. Nice to have you back and kind of get that back together and get this done.
And Jamie, don't you ever do that again. We had fun, but it's like, I feel more comfortable when you're here because you're the tech guy, you know that stuff. So yeah, it was fun. And I learned how to record things, so I feel good about that. Hi, Dr. Holly. How are you?
Hi, how are you guys? Good to hear you.
Hey, Joe. It's good to have you back as always. And, you know, we've got a good couple of things to talk about tonight. And I thought I'd start off. We always try to hit something in the current news and what's going on out there. And one of the items that leapt out at me when we were the day we were recording this was a news article out of Boston about dozens of people hospitalized at a DJ concert there. And it led me to think about there's lots of summer festivals, music festivals going on around my area in Mid-Atlantic area right now. The Firefly Festival just came through. That's a multi-day music festival. And those festivals, you know, especially if something adverse happens, if there starts to be a series of drug overdoses or things like that happen at these events, can quickly overwhelm local resources. And I wonder what your thoughts were about that, Joe.
Well, you're exactly right. You know, I mean, those things become mini disasters in a lot of ways, certainly become multi-casualty incidents very quickly. You have a large concentration of folks in a small area and often under somewhat adverse circumstances, whether that's weather or self-induced adverse circumstances. So not uncommon for those situations to lead to some problems for the responders, for sure.
Yeah, I could agree with that. Right now we have, as you probably do, we have all of our county fairs going on, even though those don't seem to stimulate high-end MCI type, you know, drugs and drinking and that kind of thing. Those are huge incidents with a lot of people, huge events, if you will. It seems like out here, a lot of what we deal with are heat related. I mean, I was even thinking about a simple high school graduation a couple years ago that for some reason they didn't want the kids to have water, probably afraid they'd fill the bottles with vodka or something. And so the fire department had to go out and deal with, I couldn't tell you what the numbers were, but a whole lot of people that were having heat exhaustion, if not going into heat stroke. So that's, and you know, when you pair up heat and alcohol, so people aren't hydrating, you know, they're not getting out of the sun. I mean, this whole combination of things, we could do a whole episode just around heat alone, but that's only one of the things we're talking about here. But certainly in the summer, that's one of the big ones.
Yeah, Joe, you and I, we were talking a little bit with Sam before we got started recording, talking about, you know, maybe there are some things we can discuss in a future episode about the differences between the event kind of response, medical response, versus the true disaster medical response.
Well, absolutely. I mean, you know, there's a lot of commonality between the two, but there's also some very distinct differences. And in many cases, just because you've had a lot of time at one, you don't necessarily have all the skill sets that you might need to do the other. So they've clearly got their differences as well.
Well, maybe we can tease the folks listening and we'll get a little bit of that and together and put that in a future episode coming up maybe next week or the week after.
Sounds great.
Excellent.
And maybe some of our people could, I'm sure they've had experiences with some of these events that I'd kind of like to hear about. So if in the meantime, they'd like to pop in to the website and give us some ideas. I mean, this is certainly a subject we could do a number of episodes on. Like I said, just looking at heat emergencies as one element. I mean, there's so many things that we're talking about under this umbrella here. This will be fun to do.
Definitely. So head over to disasterpodcast.com and leave a comment in the episode or article links of any of the articles over there and leave a comment about that article or about something in general you'd like to see. And we'll see what we can't pull together for a future episode. So, you know, tonight we were talking about our topic for the night's episode, and we really decided to talk about, you know, the overall structure of a disaster response. You know, from start to finish, from top to bottom, there are specific things in command structure and how the event occurs that that makes it official and makes sure that the federal oversight is handling things appropriately all the way down to the local level. And I'm interested to hear more about this. Sam, you and Joe are the experts here, but maybe you'd like to take off with it, Sam, and get us kicked off.
Well, I have an assumption that most people that listen to our podcasts are in the industry in some respect, and especially the field providers will have a very good grasp of what ICS, or the Incident Command System, is. So when we're taking it all the way to the federal level, we're just looking at how it builds out, because all disasters start and continue to be regional or local disasters. So you have perhaps an MCI or a, let's say, a tornado, an earthquake, whatever it may be. So, of course, that starts out a lot larger, but let's say it starts out as a regional event. So you have your usual, your engine captain starts out as your original incident commander, and then you add resources, and then it gets to the point where it exhausts the local resources. So now you bring in your mutual aid, and now perhaps you go to a regional request for resources. Well, at some point, that's going to run out. Then it usually goes to the state. Now, in some states, and I think we've alluded to this a bit, there are state medical assistance teams that may be able to fill the gap before the feds get there. And that may or may not be the case, depending on the state. But that's something Joe and I are quite familiar with. And then, now, usually what happens is the locals have to request the state team officially. So the state, therefore, makes it an official disaster at that level. And it's the same thing for the state. If the state decides they want the feds involved, then they have to get a federal declaration, which is, of course, a decision that the president makes. And then it kind of kicks in all those resources. And that's kind of where we can end up here, is all of those different resources. How are they managed? Most providers are familiar with this thing called NIMS, which we can talk about a little bit, which is your ICS developed for the larger federal level response. So I think that's kind of an overview. It's a good place to start.
And that's the National Incident Management System.
Correct.
Yeah, I'm just trying to clarify the acronyms for people out there that may not know what some of these are. So
thank you for reminding me.
No, that's okay. And I like, you know, it's important for us to note that it is the initial responders to these events that trigger this, even at the most local level. So, you know, you're the first unit on the scene. You could be initiating that mass casualty incident. I know in the state of Maryland, when a provider on the scene calls into their dispatch center and says, we have a mass casualty incident, it changes the way our protocols are applied. And that starts that process. You know, do we need additional resources? What additional resources? And then the county has to determine, do we need to go outside to mutual aid organizations and to the state? And the state needs to decide if they're going to call in other states or call in federal resources. And, you know, and so it really starts with that first individual on the ground asking for more help.
It does. And I've been sort of in those situations, not on the real big ones, but, you know, you can just imagine what goes through that person's mind when they, you know, I was very close to a major airline disaster. That was, in fact, one of the first MCIs that I was involved with. Even though I wasn't first in on it, we were very close behind. But to imagine what goes through a provider's mind when they see the magnitude of something, where it's like you get on the dispatch radio and you go, send the world. That's about the best I can say, because you know clearly that it's going to end up either a regional or maybe a state level event. And it's just to think of what all the decisions that need to be made just by that first incident commander is just pretty overwhelming. What do you think, Joe?
Well, I would agree with that completely. You know, I think it's easy to lose sight of the impact that the first few people on the scene might have, especially in these larger scale events. And, you know, I've certainly heard as much as you guys have, you know, the phone call that comes in that says, send everything you got. And of quite honestly, that really isn't a very helpful thing to say, because that doesn't really mean anything. So, you know, it starts right from that first few folks on the scene as that incident command system comes into play to ensure that the request for things that you need is as specific as you can make it and as best you're able to supply it at the time you're able with the information that you have on hand. So, you know, just sort of calling up and saying send the cavalry isn't often really very helpful, because that doesn't really mean anything.
Well, besides, somebody has to figure out, too. I mean, the regular calls are still coming in. So each agency has to figure out what they can send and not deplete their resources to handle their 911 system as well. But one thing I was thinking about, too, one of the trainings we did for one of my fire departments was that mass shooting in Aurora, Colorado, some years ago. And you can go up on the internet and actually find the audio transcripts of the dispatch for these events. And I think this is a good tool for providers. And that's actually what we did. I mean, the whole thing was like 45 minutes long or something. So we only played a section of it. But it's good to know what these guys are thinking from the beginning. As the first battalion chief is going out there, he's starting to get trying to do a size up in his head to get an idea of what resources they're going to need, because the dispatchers are waiting for that information. But before you can even get there, and in that case, you had an incident where there was a whole mall involved. You didn't know how many people were inside. You didn't yet have a connection with police to really know if the shooter was still active. You got people pouring out various doors. You have cops carrying out people from doors. This guy tried to set up a command post in two different locations, and then he turned around and everybody was pouring out the other end. So it was a really interesting exercise in all of the dynamics that will change during an event, unless you have an event like a collapse of a balcony or something where people are all kind of in the same area. This is a dynamic that changes everything, and even being able to determine the resources that you're going to need.
Well, I think you're exactly right. I think the other thing that comes to mind for me is how important the proper language is. And by that, I essentially mean making sure that the definitions that everybody uses for the words that they're using are the same. I know one of the important parts about the intercommunicability of folks in a disaster response is to make certain that we're all speaking the same language. That's obviously part of NIMS and is vitally important where, you know, somebody asks for, well, here's a classic example that I actually witnessed. I had somebody in what was left of a clinic in the New Orleans area after Katrina, who requested from their emergency operations person that they were talking to, we need lots of fluids here. We don't have enough fluids, so we need fluids. And you know, if you're like me, you're thinking that, well, they clearly need a couple of cases of IV fluid. So what mm-hmm. showed up was several cases of bottled water.
I saw that coming.
and you know, the folks trying to help thought they're doing exactly the right thing. Wow, well, here's six cases of bottled water. That'll help you with your fluids. That's not what they really needed. And it literally came down to the definition of that word and folks not appreciating how important it is to be very clear about what you need. And I think you have to think through that in terms of the ramifications of that decision. Not only did that person not get what they really needed, somebody who really did need that bottled water didn't get it because it got sent to them instead, as did the personnel and the vehicle tied up to deliver something that wasn't what they asked for in the first place. So a tremendous amount of resources wasted because somebody wasn't very clear about what it was they wanted and needed to get the job done. So, you know, NIMS has always stressed that very clear language piece, And I think it's very easy, especially when you get to the disaster medicine level of things, which tends to involve lots of people from lots of different areas and resources flowing in from all parts of the country in many cases. You have to think about local colloquialisms and, local meanings may well be very different someplace else. And be very, very clear in what you need and how you need it, and make certain that the person that you're talking to, who's the next step up the ladder, also understands very clearly what it is you're asking for.
Yeah, and I'm thinking in terms of the fact that when you look at all of the people involved in a disaster, and the medical people would know exactly what you meant when you said that, because medical people kind of speak the same language, whether they're hospital or pre-hospital. But the logisticians, who are the most important people you have, they're the ones that get you the stuff. They may not be. They may be part of the team strictly because they do logistics and they're very good at that. And like you said, the people that are at the level that make these requests may not understand. In fact, that's why ICS was kind of created, because of the dangers of even fire departments working together on a fire and not having been trained the same way or not using the same. And back then, a lot of us used 10 codes, and fire 10 codes were different than police 10 codes and ambulance 10 codes. And it just, you were left speaking Greek when you really needed to be clear. And that's why they said, wait a minute, back up. Let's all use clear text. Let's just talk to each other, because when we're in a situation where you have multiple agencies, it's not going to work. And that really was one of the reasons that ICS was created in the first place. So now you magnify that to the level of a disaster when you have local, state, federal, and like you said, the local colloquialisms, throw that in, it can be insane. But it's actually seen, for the most part, to have worked very well, except, Joe, like you said, every once in a while you're going to have something. And it was just a simple mistake, but look at the ramifications of that mistake at a number of different levels. That was a good example.
Well, and it comes down to, I think a good lesson to be learned from that story is the lesson that communication happens on two sides. And there's the person sending the message and the person receiving the message. And something I learned back in nursing school was to evaluate whether the message was received clearly when you talk to a patient or talk to somebody. Is evaluate, did they understand what you intended them to understand? And so I think it's incumbent upon people on both sides to be very clear and repeat back what they understood the message to be. If somebody had said, "So you want me to bring you 6 cases of bottled water?" Just to clarify, that would have solved the problem right there, because the other person would have said, "No, I need 2 cases of IV fluids."
And I think part of the problem with that, Jamie, too, is when you're in a disaster situation and people are stressed and they're feeling rushed, they don't think about those things as much as they should. This might have been different had it been an everyday situation. But when people are in that frenzy of got to get this done, got to get that done, I think that is part of what goes on here. What do you think about that, Joe?
Well, I think you're exactly right. They get in a rush, and I think it's just another example of showing you how important doing things in a controlled manner ultimately saves you time, as opposed to messing it up and having to go back and fix it. And in the case that we just talked about, obviously, in the end, still not having what it was you needed. So in essence, your ability, your desire to save 10 seconds in communication results in an hours long delay down the road, because you didn't get what you wanted and you don't have what you need. And I think that's a truism of disaster medicine on many, many levels. That's why those first early minutes and hours and days in a disaster are really important, because those small things that start at the beginning are amplified multiple magnitudes of order down the line by the nature of the disaster. So an appreciation for a small error that in the day-to-day processes doesn't propagate very far, but in a disaster situation where resources are limited and it takes a long time to get things done, they become magnified in many, many ways and ultimately have a huge impact on your ability to take care of patients and respond to the disaster. That may not show up for 2 days, but it's going to show up, and it's going to show up in a very big way.
Well, and on that note, consider the additional stress from the people taking care of those patients who assume that they're getting IV fluids and then told they're not. And I know this was the case in Katrina where we were, was just not having the supplies they needed for, I mean, fluids being a huge part of that because they're in a very hot environment. And knowing that these people will be compromised and or die without that, and that it all, that could be because of a simple communication error. So people are going to carry that stress and remember that piece of this forever, potentially, the frustration of not having had the ability, especially people in hospitals. I mean, pre-hospital, I think, are a little more flexible in terms of this is what we've got, this is what we got to deal with. If we don't have it, we can find another way around it or come up with something else. Where in the hospital, you don't usually run out of stuff. So it would, in my opinion, be much more frustrating for those people who are always used to having what they need to suddenly not have it and seeing that a patient's compromised by it.
And I think, you know, getting us back to the initial topic, because when you're talking between county to state and from state to federal level, I think this is probably one of the reasons why it takes some time to mobilize those resources, because there is the need to make sure, all right, so you're asking, you need to dot all the I's and cross all the T's to make sure that you're getting exactly what the agreement asks for. And when you declare an emergency, and what specific kind of emergency is it, and what specific resources are you asking for, and then the federal response or the state response back to that local jurisdiction says, all right, these are the resources we have available, these are the ones we're going to send. It takes some time for that communication to go back and forth, and that's why the local resources need to be on their own, you know, for a day or two until those resources can be brought to bear.
That's true, and it reminds me of something else that's very relevant to this conversation and something I think is a good thing. It's called resource typing. And what they've done in that case, especially on the federal level, is they have created, they've done this at state and federal levels, where they have a list of this specific resource. This is what it is. Somebody could look it up on however you do that. I suppose it's on the internet where you say, okay, I'm looking for this. I want an ambulance strike team. Okay, I think this is what I want. Okay, what is an ambulance strike team? It's 5 vehicles, a strike team leader, and a big vehicle full of supplies. Okay, so it defines very specifically what that resource is. So when you're going shopping online, where whoever is requesting these can go through this list of available resources and know exactly what it is they're getting. So there's way less guesswork than there used to be before this was created. I'm sure you're familiar with that, aren't you, Joe?
Absolutely, and you're right on target with it, Sam.
So that has, at least in the larger aspect of this, where people are requesting people and assets and vehicles and strike teams and that kind of thing, I think there's a lot less confusion than there used to be. So a lot, but we still have it at the local level, just these day-to-day things, just because of all these differences. So I imagine that will continue to be the case. So I think the solution is what you said, Jamie. We all have to remember to clarify what we want and clarify that the person we're asking actually understands what we just asked them to do.
And I think that, you know, one of the ways to help with that is through adequate training resources and making sure that local agencies and organizations that are going to work together during a disaster response, i.e. Police, fire, EMS, and local hospital and health services, all get together and train together in a meaningful way. And that doesn't just mean sitting down, viewing a web video or a web presentation that's been recorded 2 years ago, but actually getting together face-to-face for some real hands-on training where you meet each other, you start to ask these questions. And this is, and Joe, this is what you guys excel at so well at Paragon, because I think that one of the things you bring to the table is when you bring those multiple resources together, that's when they start to find these little communication differences and they start to learn about what each other, from each other's viewpoints a little bit, you know, that walk a mile in someone else's shoes, right? And bring that to bring that back to their agency or their organization saying, hey, you know, we need to think about this the next time we call for police help here at the hospital or when we need to interact together.
Well, you're exactly right. And you know, I think the best way to learn that is to have experienced it. And, you know, that those lessons are hard lessons. And obviously training is the place you want to get those lessons where they don't really matter that a case of water showed up and not a case of IV fluids. It doesn't really matter there, but it certainly matters out in the field. So the training is definitely the place to do that. And I think that's why it's important to incorporate the whole ICS structure into your training. I mean, it sounds like it's just it's in the way and it's just an outline of stuff you're supposed to do, but unless you really get into it and use it, you don't appreciate where it can also fail you. And if you don't appreciate that, you're not likely to be prepared to deal with it or to take steps to ensure that it doesn't fail you.
It practice as you play. And Jamie, I couldn't agree with you more because, well, certainly if you're sitting in front of a computer, you're there by yourself. But until you get in a real-time, real-world situation with the agencies you're actually going to be working with, are you going to discover these issues? And the sad part is that globally, people don't, counties and other agencies don't have the money to put out to do this kind of training like we used to. So we have to depend on folks like Paragon that do this for a living to fill that gap. I just wish Paragon was everywhere and more of us could take advantage of that.
It's true.
Well, thank you guys. We're obviously happy to go anywhere that we need to do the training, but appreciate you saying that.
So, you know, as we get wrapping up this episode, because we've been talking for about a half an hour or so, you know, I think we should tell people how they can find Paragon and maybe bring you guys in to provide that specialized experience and that experience training aspect to their local area and interagency event that they've got coming up.
Well, I'll be glad to do that. I know those guys. You can find Paragon on the web at paragonmedicalgroup.com. And we're also on Facebook. Just look for Paragon Medical Group. And our Twitter feed is ParagonMedEDU.
Great. And we, again, as always, appreciate your support of the Disaster Podcast and everything you and Jim and the rest of the gang bring to help us get this information out every week. And we couldn't do it without Paragon's generous assistance. So we urge everybody out there, check out their website, friend them on Facebook, on Twitter, and interact with them. Find out what resources are out there. Ask questions. You know, I know Joe and Jim are both happy to answer questions from anybody about just about anything to do with disaster and training topics. So, you know, make them a resource that you go to.
Well, thanks again, Jamie. We're actually in the process of getting some revisions done of the website to get a much better offering out there of the kind of stuff that we can do. What's on there is now becoming a little dated. We've been really busy and we haven't had much of a chance to catch it up recently. So we're working hard to get some new stuff on the web and give folks a little bit better idea of what we can do.
Fantastic. Sam, where can folks find you?
Well, time does fly when you're having fun. That was a great conversation. I can't believe we actually talked that long. In social media, of course, SamBradley11 at Twitter, Sam Bradley on Facebook, and mostly disasterpodcast.com. You can reach me there.
Great. And everybody can find me under the handle PodMedic at just about every social media site and resource out there. And of course, also over at disasterpodcast.com. And I'm, again, Sam and I and Joe and the rest of the gang here really urge you to interact with us. If you've got a topic you'd like us to cover, if you'd like to share a link to a news item with us or ask us a question or make a suggestion or a comment, you can do that over at disasterpodcast.com. Below every article, there's a comments area. You just click in there and leave your ideas and thoughts. It emails us and lets us know, and we'll get back to you. We promise. Sam, you want to take us out?
Well, as always, it's true that disaster medicine is not your everyday medicine.